Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Today is the 10th day of the new year, 2019, which is on the cusp of two decades into the third millennium of a human-measured period now known as the Common Era, which until recently counted the lapse of years since the martyrdom of a biblical Messiah. Humanity, by its own contrivance, has cast itself into a new century, the first of a millennium, which as yet has few discernible trails into its distant interior, a vast space of time no one alive at its advent will be on the planet to characterize or define. Indeed, how would anyone summarize the previous millennium? Those of us who cross through an invisible time portal of human conjecture, swiftly moving past as our ancestors might have quickly trekked over the Siberian land bridge between old and new worlds and into an immense alien landscape. We are time pioneers, as all organic sentience must necessarily be. After all, even a single year, like a century or a millennium, is largely unmapped, except for annually repetitive grid marks on calendars, such as seasons and holidays, which are somewhat like geographical grid lines, plotted with latitude and longitude overlaid over vast bowls of ocean, and the firma of Terra we human gophers burrow into as though it were a warm womb sweet home. The true millennium, this adolescent century ordains, really started in the middle of the 20th century, when humanity cracked the atom, on the aptly named Day of Trinity, when the first human-conceived nuclear explosion converted a section of desert into glass. It was also a moment human beings realized this cosmic power they unleashed from its locks might be their doom. It was one of those exceptionally rare moments that seemed as though everything before that moment was inexorably directed toward it and afterward will be measured from it until some other great cosmic mystery overwhelms our perceptions. Exactly at that precise point, history could have been renumbered if we insist on a bicameral chronicle of before and after. The mushroom cloud has supplanted the cross as humanity's truly universal icon, which might finally be recognized a century or more up the line, as was the Christian calendar a few centuries after the crucifixion and subsumed every other cultural register of the passing days. Perhaps at some point in this onrushing century, the calendar might be rectified and age itself half a century, beginning when the 20th century blew its gut out in the summer of 1945. Before atom and after atom is the true historical divide. Next year, 2020, will be the 75th year of the nuclear age. We have changed centuries and millennia. Yet the millions of years humanoids have existed on planet Earth are hardly reflected in the three millennia our age records, or the classically archived previous era the Renaissance reopened in the medieval mind half a millennium ago. Civilization is at least 10,000 years old. Homo sapiens sapiens, our current anthropological evolution, is perhaps 100,000 years or more. 5,000 years of written record, the rest unrecorded and unknown except for a scattering of broken skulls and bone fragments, shards of chipped rock, and primeval cave paintings. This new millennial age, rather than the third of a parochial chronology that dogmatically dates the before and after of a 33-year-old carpenter from Nazareth, or a newer, more or less non-theological appellation, BCE, CE, before the Common Era, respectively, might more accurately be counted as the 100th millennia of at least our particular strain of the great apes. Humanity's rise through complex genetic spiderwebs of primates and hominids, developing wit and organizational skills during the 98% of its span that has been spent hunting as a clever and rapacious carnivore, its subsequent civilizations based on agriculture, commerce, and warfare, seems barely a breath in the life of Earth. Yet its short reign has metamorphosed most of the above sea level world to its own taste and style. Humanity eternally pushes at the edge of evolution, incessantly, impatiently, and recklessly remaking the natural world into its own image. Homo sapiens sapiens races through spectrums of time we calculate and measure, but little understand, propelled into every moment with impatience, hope, and avarice, overturning nature as well as our own history. Regarding each as we rush past is irrelevant, and perhaps the only consistency to our history is our disdain of nature. Regarding the natural world in which we have spent the greater part of our span, as an adversary to be overcome and altered to our design and use, whether it be domestication of grains and animals to cloning of them and ourselves for future suzerainty over the entire planet. We think nuclear power makes us gods. Probably nothing can stop or even deter the dynamical surge of our species except extinction, either by ourselves or our inability to catch up with an expanding universe. Yet half a century ago, at the very beginning of the nuclear age, writerly gadfly Philip Wiley made a sagacious observation when he wrote, "The sum total of human works does not equal in all parts put together the achievements of the life forms of plant and insect in a square foot of grass." And Sir Thomas Brown wrote in the 17th century that the created world is only a small parentheses in eternity. In that sense, we are little more than cartoon dogs laying on roofs of doghouses, staring up at the stars. Whether or not the calendar eventually changes to reflect humanity's real course through time, we are the first to cross over or be born into this new century millennium. We will probably be thought quaint by later arrivals in the century. But especially to those of us who crossed millennia, it means something phenomenal to straddle two millenniums and two centuries. It makes a significant impact on our lives, which no one for 1,000 years can equal. And now, the Oregon coast is directly affected by the so-called partial government shutdown by a petulant president who seems determined to prevent cocoa-colored drug-smuggling terrorist toddlers from infesting the USA and threatens a national emergency, though he seems to have backed off from bugling out the troops for the moment. The Coast Guard is absolutely necessary on this stormy ocean shore, especially at this intense stormy time of season. Yet the men and women whom we depend upon to rescue seafarers in distress are being forced to serve without pay, to risk their own lives responding to calls for rescue at sea regardless of time, weather, or circumstance. It behooves coastal folk to protect their protectors, especially in regards to food and housing that might be in jeopardy during their fiscal distress, and to extend credit until they are finally paid for being semper paratus, always ready to assist in their boats and helicopters anybody in trouble at sea. Their work is as vital and indispensable as police, fire, and medical responders ashore. A remarkable and tragic example of the hazardous and often fatal work Coast Guard rescuers experience occurred nearly 60 years ago outside the notorious Columbia River Bar, which might be considered a legacy memory. I wrote about it for the Columbia River Maritime Museum's quarterdeck, and should probably mention that my great respect and gratitude for Coast Guard people is that I was rescued with three others of my crewmates when an albacore tuna boat we worked aboard capsized and sank in the Columbia River Bar in the summer of 1972. I call it, "They Don't Have to Come Back." The Columbia River Bar is the place where the River of the West and the mighty Pacific Ocean meet, with dramatic and often violent results. Hundreds of ships and boats have been lost on the bar, Seafarers and river cruisers have lost their lives by the score. Mariners call it the graveyard of the Pacific. U.S. Coast Guard's people are required to respond to every distress signal along this rough stretch, no matter what weather or time of day. They have saved countless numbers of vessels and lives, an average of 600 persons a year on the Lower Columbia alone. They are ordinary men and women who take extraordinary risks in small boats and aircraft. Most of the time they get back safely, but sometimes their luck runs out. One January night, 58 years ago, the Columbia River Bar claimed the lives of 5 Coast Guardsmen and 2 ocean fishermen they attempted to rescue. 3 Coast Guard vessels were lost, as well as the fishing boat they set out to save from gale-stricken seas. 2 men who survived that failed rescue attempt visited Astoria in the spring of 1990 to recount the tragic night of January 12, 1961. Daryl Joseph Murray and Larry Edwards were Coast Guard coxswains of 2 of the 3 rescue boats that sank that night. The coxswain of the 3rd boat died in the attempt, along with most of his crew. Murray had never forgotten that night in 1961. Even after 20 years spent in the Coast Guard and motor lifeboat stations, the disaster continued to affect and define his life. The events of that evening began late in the afternoon of January 12th with a distress call from the fishing boat Mermaid, received by Cape Disappointment Life Station just inside the mouth of the Columbia River on the Washington side. The Mermaid of Ilwaco, Washington, had lost its rudder trying to beat into the river ahead of a storm and was drifting helplessly toward the surf north of Peacock Spit. Murray, a bosun's mate, described as a petty officer of long experience and established competence in lifeboat stations, quickly dispatched 2 boats. "I sent Larry Edwards out in a 36-foot boat, and I took a 40-foot boat," Murray said during his visit to the Columbia Maritime Museum. The solid and sturdy but slow 36-foot boat was the standard motor lifeboat used by the Coast Guard at the time. It was constructed of wood and was capable of righting itself if capsized. The 40-footer did not have that capability. Not meant to be used as a lifeboat, it generally served as a utility and patrol craft. The 40-footer was not designed for rough water, but it was faster than the 36-footer, Murray explained. "I thought I could get out there and get a tow line to the Mermaid before it hit the beach and turn the tow over to Larry when he reached me." What happened instead was that the weather, bad to begin with, continued to get worse. Unable to establish direct radio contact with the Mermaid, Murray lost valuable time searching for the fishing vessel. Neither of the Coast Guard boats had radar. The Jana Joe, a fish boat from Ilwaco, skippered by Roy Gunnery, assisted by relaying Mermaid's calls. It was after dark before Murray was able to talk to the Mermaid. "I told them to turn their spotlight on the clouds," Murray said. "I spotted them immediately after that. When I reached the boat, I told the 2 men aboard they should transfer to my boat. They refused, so we took them under tow." Edwards, in the 36-foot boat, finally reached the other 2 vessels near Buoy 1, which marks the beginning of the shipping channel into the Columbia River. His boat had taken a beating crossing the bar. It was leaking at the seams and the radio antenna was broken. He did not take over the tow. Plans had changed due to the worsening weather. The 52-foot motor lifeboat Triumph from Point Adams on the Oregon side of the river was coming out to take the Mermaid in. The Triumph was a 25-year veteran of rescues in all types of weather at the Columbia River Bar. It was wooden-hulled, one of only 2 boats of the same design, built in 1935. The man at the helm that night was bosun's mate John L. Culp, a 31-year-old career Coast Guardsman who was considered an excellent lifeboat commander. By the time Culp left the Point Adams station, 4 miles upriver from the bar, gale winds from the southwest had whipped up huge swells. The Triumph did not reach the other 3 boats at Buoy 1 until 2 hours later. Culp took over the tow of the Mermaid from Murray. All 4 vessels started toward the river. Then everything went wrong at once. Murray's boat capsized trying to cross the bar. A few minutes later, Triumph went over while attempting to retrieve a parted tow line to the Mermaid. Culp and 4 of his men were lost. Only 1 member of the crew of the Triumph survived, later washing ashore unharmed. Murray and his two-man crew survived only because of Edwards' quick thinking. His boat was near Murray's when it overturned. Responding to the 40-footer, Edwards smashed up against the upended keel of the other boat during the rescue of the three men. He turned his battered lifeboat out to sea and headed for the Coast Guard lightship Columbia, anchored on station about 7 miles outside the river entrance. In the meantime, the Mermaid, still afloat, was taken into tow once again by another 36-foot boat sent from Point Adams to assist in the rescue. The 36-footer's coxswain also set out for the lightship, but lost the Mermaid to a large swell that capsized the fishing vessel, killing the three men aboard, two brothers, and a survivor from Triumph they had pulled from the water. After another hour of plowing full throttle through the storm, the 36-foot boat piloted by Larry Edwards only barely reached lightship Columbia. The stern was awash, the engine room half full of water and rudder control almost gone. Edwards circled the lightship for nearly 2 hours in an attempt to transfer the men. Knowing time was running out, he finally managed to come alongside. One member of his crew was swept from the Jacob's Ladder by a wave, only to be snatched again from the water by the lightship's chief engineer as he rose on the crest of another wave. As the last man's foot left the 36-footer, it broke its lines and sank from sight, the only 36-foot motor lifeboat ever lost by the Coast Guard in over 7 decades of service. Despite the storm, other Coast Guard vessels and aircraft searched for the missing men the rest of the night and into the next day. Flares were dropped. Shore parties combed both sides of the river. Only 2 bodies were found. Culp's body came ashore near Cape Disappointment later that night, close to where his surviving crew member, Gordon Huggins, beached. The body of one of the fishermen was found a few days later. The disaster shocked residents of the small towns on the lower Columbia. Local newspapers questioned the quality of the Coast Guard's rescue craft. A 3-day inquiry was held, and all survivors provided details of what happened that night. The irony of the situation was that change was already in progress. A 44-foot all-steel motor lifeboat was going into production to replace the 36-footers. The 44-footers, which have been called the best life-saving craft ever developed, were succeeded in 1990 by a new class of 47-foot aluminum motor lifeboats that have since themselves been replaced. A plaque to the memory of the lost crew of Triumph was placed near the Point Adams lifeboat station in Hammond, which was closed in 1967 because it was deemed too far upriver from where it was most needed. John Culp, coxswain of Triumph, received a posthumous gold life-saving medal, the Coast Guard's highest award. His crew received silver life-saving medals, 4 of them awarded posthumously. Larry Edwards, coxswain of the 36-footer lost that night, received a gold life-saving medal for his role in rescuing the crew of the 40-foot utility boat. Darryl Murray, coxswain of the 40-footer, received a commendation medal for his part in the ill-fated rescue. He made a 20-year career of the Coast Guard. His visit to Astoria and the Columbia River Maritime Museum in 1990 was prompted by the haunting memory of that night. Larry Edwards also spent 20 years in the Coast Guard and afterward worked for the Alaska Ferry System. A few weeks after Murray's unexpected arrival in Astoria, Edwards visited his fisherman son, Blaine, who lived in Il Waco. Asked about the night of the Triumph disaster, he responded that he had been off duty waiting for a friend when the Mermaid's call was received at Cape Disappointment. He said it was dumb luck, and that's a quote, that he had seen Murray's capsized boat in the darkness and storm. He remembered seeing the Triumph with Mermaid in tow, starting across the bar just after his crew rescued Murray's from the capsized 40-footer. No one now living saw the Triumph sink. Edwards said he chose to head out to sea because he was afraid his battered lifeboat would not survive crossing the bar. He drove at full throttle through mountainous seas because of his concern the sputtering engine of the 36-footer would quit. He said, "I never thought about not making it." Lightship Columbia, which figures prominently in this story, was retired in 1979 after nearly 30 years' service with the Coast Guard, replaced by an automated light buoy, which locals joke looked like a large spark plug, replaced by an even more sophisticated electronic beacon. Today, Columbia is on display at the Maritime Museum and is designated a National Historic Landmark. Visitors explore her deck and interior at her quiet berth at Astoria's 17th Street Pier, where two Coast Guard cutters are often moored alongside. There have been changes in Coast Guard philosophy since the night of January 12, 1961. The old motto, "You must always go out, but you don't have to come back," has been altered to reflect the discernment of on-call rescuers. A tragic postscript to the January 12, 1961 disaster occurred on January 11, 1991, a day before a 30th anniversary commemoration and reunion in Astoria of the 11 survivors of that night, initiated by Daryl Murray, coxswain of the 40-foot boat that was lost. A Coast Guard rescue swimmer and two fishermen died when a fishing boat that had been filling with water sank while under tow by a Coast Guard rescue vessel crossing the bar. Not only did the three men die in the same area, near Peacock Spit, the dead Coast Guardsman was from the crew of the Triumph II, which was named after the 52-foot boat that capsized with the loss of five of its crew 30 years earlier. Gordon Huggins, the single survivor of the first Triumph, was at the reunion, which was also attended by families of participants and by locals who remembered that deadly night. And that was something I wrote, "They Don't Have to Come Back," which was in the spring 1990 issue of the Columbia River Maritime Museum's publication, The Quarterdeck. And I have just learned this morning that three fishermen died at the Newport Bar just recently, maybe just today or last night. And so I dedicate this program to them. And now, in regard to Donald Trump's threat of a national emergency that summons dark visions of brown shirt menace or local militia malice, "If Trump declares a state of emergency, he might actually cause one," by Andrea Pitzer, and she wrote this for the Washington Post. President Trump recently announced that he could call a national emergency, and that's a quote, to build the wall on the border with Mexico. Despite his assertions to the contrary, no national security crisis exists at the border. Representative Adam Smith, a Democrat from Washington, has indicated that the president might very well be able to use his powers to build a wall. But even if Trump fails to deliver one more mile of poured concrete or steel slats with his ploy, the country would face significant harm from his imaginary emergency. Indeed, if he continues down this path, he may well create a real national emergency that will eclipse his fake one. Writing a history of concentration camps around the globe, I have spent several years looking at how leaders, revolutionaries, and military juntas have used states of exception situations in which ordinary laws are deferred or no longer apply. The most notorious example played out between the world wars, before Adolf Hitler was appointed German chancellor in 1933. Article 48 of the Weimar Constitution was invoked more than 100 times, allowing the president to override legislative authority. After his appointment, Nazi leadership employed this extraordinary measure more aggressively to cement Hitler's use of dictatorial power for more than a decade. But as philosopher Giorgio Agamben noted in his writing on the topic, states of exception weren't just for Nazis. Article 23 of Argentina's constitution allowed for the suspension of constitutional guarantees in the event of domestic disorder. When generals seized power there in 1976, they made intricate, exhaustive use of the article to pervert the legal process. In Chile, a coup on September 11, 1973, the other 9/11, institutionalized extrajudicial governance, and the resulting state of emergency remained in place for 15 years. More recently, Myanmar's fledgling democracy declared a state of emergency over violence in the western state of Rakhine in 2012. The government imposed emergency powers to segregate their Rohingya Muslim population, isolating it behind checkpoints that helped lay the groundwork for ethnic cleansing. again and again when democracies are destabilized. Declaring a state of emergency is the linchpin of the process. As Supreme Court Justice Robert Jackson noted in 1952, emergency powers, quote, tend to kindle emergencies. The United States has its own history to consider. In December 1941, President Franklin D. Roosevelt put Hawaii under martial law in the wake of the attack on Pearl Harbor. Early the following year, he signed Executive Order 9066, which led to the internment of about 120,000 Japanese Americans, most of whom were U.S. citizens. According to the popular understanding, the United States was frightened into violations of its own ideals, but that idea is false. Francis Biddle, the Attorney General at the time, as well as U.S. Naval Intelligence and even J. Edgar Hoover at the FBI, understood that mass internment was unnecessary. But the power of the executive, in this case a president deferring to the military, overruled the advice of key officials. The Supreme Court backed the president, denying justice to tens of thousands of detainees. States of emergency don't always require war. The McCarran Internal Security Act, on the books from 1950 until 1971, authorized the president to declare an internal emergency and detain suspected subversives in internment camps. President Harry S. Truman rejected the act's extraordinary powers, saying they made a mockery of the Bill of Rights and were a long step toward totalitarianism. A defiant Cold War Congress passed the legislation over his veto. After Congress defanged the most expansive of these detention powers in 1971, the Senate Committee on Government Operations was dismayed to find that several states of emergency were already in place in the United States. And some of them had been for decades. Because they had never been canceled, these held out the possibility for sweeping extrajudicial actions by any sitting president. In 1976, Congress passed the National Emergencies Act in an attempt to clear up this danger by defining executive authority more clearly and subjecting emergencies to congressional renewal. Instead, the act served to institutionalize presidential authority over emergencies, with Congress exercising only a whisper of its legally mandated oversight once in the past, 42 years. Dozens of national emergencies remain open and in place, weakening the system and setting it up for abuse. Two key differences make Trump's plan particularly risky. The first is that no actual emergency exists. No equivalent to Pearl Harbor, 9/11, or even economic collapse. Instead, Trump threatens an emergency to punish another branch of the government for constitutionally exercising its authority. The second difference relates more directly to the president himself. U.S. courts have often left space for presidents to respond quickly to events threatening the country's stability, with the assumption that the executive branch is considering all the available intelligence and will have the most informed perspective, a premise that simply does not apply to Trump. Totalitarianism rises out of a process, not a single event. Declaring a state of exception in response to a political impasse would be a big step toward degrading an already vulnerable system. A fake emergency could trigger a real catastrophe, one that a split Congress would be unlikely to resolve, and that a Supreme Court sympathetic to an imperial presidency might even worsen. We have more than a century of precedents at home and abroad to demonstrate all the ways things could go wrong. And that was an article for the Washington Post by Andrea Pitzer, who is the author of One Long Night, A Global History of Concentration Camps. And I highly recommend that book. I would like to close this program with a poem by Juanita Huebner, Sanctuary. Losing her family, the village burned, screamed, disappeared. She walks days with only one of her children in thin, scarred arms. That fire set marching by the government, annihilating time. She arrives in eyes, lagrimas, horror, exhaustion. Their lies of unspeakable meaning roared distances, bonds, cords, rivers, an unwoven and bleeding trauma, a refugee camp reduced to shadow in the world, killing peasants for not being cost-effective. She stares into pounded dirt, corn, sleepless. It is a woman's life. It is a woman's life. And that was Sanctuary by Juanita Huebner. And this is Michael McCusker.